Hello, everybody. This is Jay Shapiro. Thanks for listening. This is the program that starts on the Monday, 21st of May, which corresponds to the seventh day in the Hebrew month of Sivan. Our program generally goes on the air on Sunday, but this week, Sunday was Shavuot, the Feast of Weeks, I guess is what it's called. And therefore, we're starting one day late. This has been a very exciting time for the last couple of weeks in Israel because of two things that are happening in parallel, one good and one not so good. I just want to review this very quickly. For thousands of years, the Jewish people has had a period of time called the High Holidays, which in Hebrew is called the Yomim Noraim, which means the days of awe. And this is a period that starts on the new year, which is the first day of the Hebrew month of Tishrei, which comes out in the fall, generally in September or October. This is a two-day holy day, which is followed by 10 days later by Yom Kippur, which is the Day of Atonement, which is on the 10th day of Tishrei. This is followed by the holiday of Sukkot, or Tabernacles, which starts on the 15th day of Tishrei, and this is followed by Shmini Atzeret, or the Day of Solemn Assembly, which is the 22nd day of the Hebrew month of Tishrei. So from the 1st of Tishrei until the 22nd, we have a holy day period of essentially 3 weeks long. But now we have a new period, which is now being called the Israeli High Holidays. It begins on the traditional biblical holiday of Passover, Pesach, on the 15th day of the month of Nisan, which is in the springtime. Then it includes the Holocaust Remembrance Day, then the Memorial Day for those who have fallen in the defense of the State of Israel, and it includes both military and civilian deaths, and includes the period starting from the beginning of the Zionist enterprise at the end of the 19th century. Then we have Israel Independence Day, which is celebrated according to the Hebrew calendar, the fifth month of Hebrew month of Iyar. Actually, when it occurred back in 1948, it was the 15th of May. And until this year, the Israeli high holiday season ended on the 28th of Iyar, which is the day that Jerusalem was united under Jewish sovereignty in the Six-Day War back in 1967. I'll say more about that historically later, but the point I wanted to make now is that this year, the 28th of Iyar, Jerusalem Day, came out on a Sunday last week, which was the 13th of May. But this year, a new day of celebration was added. On the day after Jerusalem Day, the U.S. Embassy was officially opened in Jerusalem in a very impressive ceremony. So the Israeli high holidays have become one day longer. I don't know whether the annual celebration, the move of the U.S. Embassy to Israel's capital, will be held on the secular day, May 14th, or on the Hebrew day, the 29th of Iyar. I suppose those who make these decisions will decide. In any event, it's a really great and emotional day, and it was really something. There were 150 people here from the United States on the official delegation. All the streets were covered with Israeli flags and American flags, and it really was really a very special time. Now, I think it's important that we talk a little about the history. I mentioned at the beginning a few minutes ago that there's something negative happening also, and that's the Palestinian response to the moving of the U.S. embassy, but I'll speak more about that later. Right now, I think it's a good time to remind the listeners of the history of the relationship between the United States and Israel's capital, because it's an interesting history, and I think it should be reviewed. To many people, it's very common, especially those who have lived through this period, but we have to be reminded. You have to keep in mind that every sovereign country has the right to determine location of its own capital. Yet most countries in the world have denied this right to Israel. When Israel was established back in 1948, it was naturally that the founders would establish the capital in Jerusalem. After all, Jerusalem was the capital of successive Jewish kingdoms for hundreds of years in biblical times, ever since the reign of King David, which is almost 4,000 years ago. And throughout the centuries of exile, Jerusalem has occupied a major place in Jewish prayers. Jews face Jerusalem three times a day when they say the three mandatory prayers. And here in Jerusalem, we face toward the Old City and toward the what's now called the Wailing Wall or the Western Wall. We here in Jerusalem face the Old City in our prayers three times a day. And also, I live about a little bit less than a mile away from the temple site, so we have occasion to visit there fairly often. At any rate, for two millennia, Jerusalem was other hands, not in Jewish hands, and Jews have long yearned to return to Jerusalem and make it once again the capital of an independent Jewish state. During the War of Independence back in 1948, the first Israeli Prime Minister, David Ben-Gurion, made a special effort, a military effort, to keep Jerusalem in Jewish hands. However, he was only partially successful. Israel kept control of the western section of the city, but lost the eastern section to the Jordanian army, which invaded. And the Jordanian army took over the Jewish quarter and the Western Wall, which is the holiest site in Jewish life. And they went about destroying just about everything. Immediately after Israel declared independence, several countries, including the United States and Russia, recognized the new state. As a matter of fact, it was very interesting. President Truman recognized the Jewish state within less than an hour after it was declared. And essentially, he went down in Jewish history. First, after the destruction of the First Temple, the Jews went into exile in Babylon, which is now Iraq. But Babylon was captured by Persia, and the Persian king, Cyrus, gave the Jews permission to go back to Jerusalem and rebuild it. So Cyrus was a very famous person in Jewish history, and President Truman, back in 1948, arose, I guess is the best word, to a position held by, Cyrus, by recognizing the Jewish state. And now, of course, President Trump is the third person in history to recognize Jewish sovereignty, and in the case of Trump, it's the city of Jerusalem itself, the ancient capital. So we have three people, Cyrus, more than 2,000 years ago, President Truman, 70-some years ago, and now Trump, who are really have become major figures in Jewish history. At any rate, back in 1948, Jordan took over the Old City in part of East and Eastern Jerusalem, and what happened was that in December of 1949, Israel declared the western section of Jerusalem as its capital and moved the Knesset, the president, the courts, the ministries, the government, most of the government agencies to Jerusalem. However, the international community denied recognition of West Jerusalem, Israel's capital. Between 1948 and 1967, Jerusalem was divided. Which interesting, by the way, an interesting historical note when you think about it. During that time, in 1948, Berlin was a divided city. The political and diplomatic situation of Berlin was something that was divided between the four powers, and the German government set itself up in Bonn. It didn't move to Berlin until the collapse of the Iron Curtain. But interestingly enough, no countries had any difficulty in recognizing East Berlin as the capital of East Germany, even though, in a sense, the capital in Bonn was only a temporary one. But the world, all the countries in the world, recognized East Berlin as the capital of East Germany, even though West Berlin was in the hands of the German government. Anyhow, all Israeli efforts to gain recognition for Jerusalem failed. Only 16 countries, primarily from Latin America, establish their embassies in the city. But it's reasonable to assume that the U.S. should establish its embassy, at least in West Jerusalem. And if the United States would have done so back in 1948, there's no doubt that many other countries would have followed suit, as indeed they're doing now. During the 1967 Six-Day War, 51 years ago, Israel captured and annexed East Jerusalem and unified the city. Since then, the capital status, the status of the capital has not been recognized by a lot of countries. Nobody expected the conflict to persist for so many years. After the 1973 Yom Kippur War, several countries, particularly in Africa, severed diplomatic relations and closed their embassies in Jerusalem. So in 1980, the remaining countries that had recognized Jerusalem closed their embassy following the passage by the Israeli Knesset of a law or a declaration which stated that the city of Jerusalem would remain the complete and united capital of Israel. So the rest of the countries pulled themselves out. Since the 1993 Oslo peace process, the Palestinians have demanded that East Jerusalem be made the capital of their independent state. Now, in October 1995, the American Congress passed by overwhelming majorities the Jerusalem Embassy Act. It stated that Jerusalem should remain unified, that it should be recognized as Israel's capital, and that the U.S. Embassy should be moved from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem by May 31, 1999. This passed, by the way, in the Senate by a vote of 93-5, and in the House by 374-37, overwhelmingly approved. However, the law allowed the president to sign a waiver every 6 months on national security grounds. So Presidents Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Barack Obama all invoked the waiver and failed to implement the law. In other words, every 6 months they said that they're holding back on moving the American embassy to Jerusalem because of national security grounds. They assumed, apparently, that moving the embassy would compromise Palestinian-Israeli negotiations and it would cause violent protests against the U.S. across the Muslim world. Now, a little bit has actually happened. The violent protests are only taking place here in Israel, and I'll speak more about that later. But the original fear was that the violent protests would take place all over the Muslim world. But interestingly enough, that the Muslim world has its own problems. For example, today, the Sunni Muslim countries, which are, of course, like Saudi Arabia, are at odds or in conflict, if you will, or are not getting along too well with the Shiite Muslim countries, which are headed by Iran, which is ancient Persia. So now the fact that the U.S. Embassy has been moved to Jerusalem doesn't seem to bother the Saudi Arabians because they got their own problem. They don't want to get the United States angry at them. During the 2016 presidential election campaign, candidate Donald Trump repeatedly promised to move the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem. And interestingly enough, just about everybody running for office said they would move the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem because they wanted to make sure to get the Jewish vote. On June 5th, 2017, just a year ago, U.S. Senate unanimously passed a resolution 90-0 that reaffirmed the 1995 Jerusalem Embassy Act and called upon the president to implement it. Now, on December 6th, only a few months ago, 2017, President Trump recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital and instructed the State Department to prepare to move the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem. The Palestinians were very upset. They suspended contact with the United States. Trump is supposedly preparing, Trump administration is preparing a peace plan, and the Palestinians suspended contact with the U.S. Many commentators and experts forecast widespread violent protests against the United States and the Muslim world, but it turns out they were wrong. On February 23, 2018, Trump announced that the U.S. Embassy would move to Jerusalem on May 14, 2018, to coincide with the 70th anniversary of Israel's Declaration of Independence. From the beginning of his term, Trump has aspired to build a legacy of transformative events. The transfer of the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem was one of those events. Trump apparently wanted to demonstrate that he fulfills campaign promises, and he also wished to satisfy his political base, especially the evangelical Christians who have strongly and consistently insisted on recognition of Jerusalem as the capital and the embassy transfer. Now, Trump also believes his move will rouse the stalled Palestinian-Israel negotiation. It may occur, as Trump has indicated, Israel will have to make reciprocal concessions in return for the transfer of the embassy. Now, we don't know what they are yet, but so far, as Abba Eben said, the Palestinians have never missed an opportunity to miss an opportunity. So right now, the Palestinians are sitting tight. They won't negotiate anymore. Several other states have now announced that they will move their embassies to Jerusalem, including Guatemala, Honduras, Paraguay, the Czech Republic, and Romania. And the president of Guatemala is here in Israel now to officially sponsor that move. Trump would be remembered in Jewish history, who, unlike his predecessors, has the courage to correct what is really a long-standing diplomatic anomaly or a mistake. This should have been done years ago. So we have a situation now, and what I've tried to do in this second segment of the program is to review the history of what's happened since the State of Israel was declared and went through all the political machinations that have occurred, people finding excuses for either not moving their embassy to Jerusalem or moving their embassy out of Jerusalem with various excuses like the Six-Day War and things of that nature. But these are all just excuses. So now President Trump has taken this very big step, and hopefully, we don't know what he's planning as far as negotiations with the Palestinians are, but of course, moving our capital is something the United States is not going to. Moving its embassy to our capital is something that the United States is not going to back off of. And the ball essentially is in the hands of the negotiators here in the Middle East. So far, the Palestinians have consistently maintained a position not recognizing the move of the U.S. embassy. As a matter of fact, they actually don't recognize the State of Israel. And that's a story unto itself, which I'll say more about later in the program. What I wanted to do in this segment of the program was simply to review the history and to repeat my observation that three names are going to be remembered in Jewish history for making bold moves. One is Cyrus, the king of Persia, more than 2,000 years ago. The other is President Truman, who acted against his own State Department and recognized the State of Israel as an entity, even though the United States didn't recognize Jerusalem. They recognized Israel as an established entity. And now you have President Trump, who has taken the bold step, for whatever reason. His reasons could be very complicated, including the support he gets from the fundamental Christians in the United States, who, by the way, are our primary support in the United States. Fundamental Christians support Israel much more strongly than the progressive Jews do, and that's a story unto itself. At any rate, I'll be back after the break, and again, I simply wanted to give a little history lesson. I'll be back in a moment. You're back with Jay Shapiro. In this portion of the program, I want to present some facts and then comment on them. I want to refer to the fact that around the world, this was getting a very bad press, and the picture is being painted that Israel is firing upon innocent and peaceful protesters using lethal weapons. This is a complete distortion of the facts on the ground, and I want to read from some authentic sources what the facts on the ground are. There is an organization that gathers information from the Palestinian media. It's headed by Itamar Marcus and Nan Zuberdick, and they monitor what's happening. Now, let us first start off with the kind of information that's used on the Palestinian Facebook pages, in which they're directing rioters in Gaza, and they give explicit instructions to murder and kidnap Israelis. In particular, on May 14th, the day the U.S. Embassy was opened in Jerusalem, they are encouraged to bring weapons to the demonstrations and use these weapons to either murder or capture Israelis. Israeli soldiers may have been facing Palestinians who were actually well-armed with the goal of murdering and kidnapping Israelis. The instructions are the following, and I'm reading now from the translation of the Palestinian Facebook page. They say to the young people, treat seriously and do not take lightly the request to bring a knife, a dagger, or a handgun, if you have one, and leave them under your clothes. Do not use them or show them, except if you identify one of the Israeli soldiers or settlers. Do not kill Israeli citizens. Try to capture them, as we know that the capture can set any conditions he wants. The instructions also describe how masses of Palestinians would collectively breach the security fence aided by bulldozers. They're told to advance individually, make do with the collective advance according to the instructions, because there will be bulldozers behind you that will advance in order to break down the walls. Do not busy yourselves with the wounded or the martyrs, as the medical teams behind us are ready for this. Just pay attention to the battlefield and act wisely according to the instruction. So obviously the portrayal of the events in Gaza by some news agencies or as peaceful demonstrations is clearly false. The Facebook page by the Palestinian leadership called the Great March of Return was opened in March 2018 and states its goal as live and continuous coverage of the activities of the Great March of Return. It posts updates from the march every few minutes and has about 6,000 followers. It's not clear if Hamas itself is involved in the page. There's also a second Facebook page called Gaza Now, and it talks about the March of Return. Now, the following is a full translation of the instructions to Gazans to bring weapons and murder and kidnap Israelis. I'm taking the trouble to read this because I think it's important for the listeners to know what is happening, actually happening. And the instructions say the following. This is translated from the Arabic. To rebelling young people, tomorrow we will begin by standing along these roads at 10 a.m. at a certain time we will notify about later. There will be a collective advance towards the barbed wire fence until we move it with our strong hands and exposed bodies all at once while being aided by loudspeakers and calls of Allahu Akbar, Allah is greatest, by the masses. Therefore, do not advance individually. Make do with the collective advance, according to the instructions, because there will be bulldozers that will advance in order to remove the fence. Do not treat seriously the request to bring knife, dagger, and so forth. Disperse the Israeli snipers, make them leave their posts and run, and always check the area and think what to do and then act. Do not busy yourself with the wounded, as the medical teams behind you will take care of this. These are instructions given directly to the Gazans, some of whom I understand also from other news reports are being paid. One final thing, that is that, as I said, the world media are painting us as shooting at innocents. Now, let me give you a little review of what's happened. This is my program is not a news program. I'm supposed to comment on the news. But sometimes it's important that the news be known. And I think the actual news about what's happening in Gaza is not being spread properly. Since the end of March, there have been mass protests along the Gaza border. They've been well organized and planned. The two main days in which they're going to be activated are March 30th and, of course, the date when the American Embassy opens in Jerusalem. The mass protests, which coincided with the U.S. opening of its embassy in Jerusalem, resulted in 60 killed and 2,700 wounded, according to the Gaza-based Palestinian reports. The protests have been organized around five locations next to Israel's security fence. They took place using different tactics and methods. For instance, protesters began lighting massive fires with burning tires. They began launching fire kites into Israeli fields to set the fields aflame, which they did. And they destroyed a lot of agriculture on the kibbutzim on the Gaza border. They tore down a section of one of the fences' barbed wire. It was during that protest that a reliable source provided some insight into the methods that Hamas used. They gather on Fridays with tens of thousands at the very back of the protest. Hundreds of meters from the fence are tents and field hospitals, prayer areas, and families are sitting there. This is where Hamas officials show up in the morning or early afternoon to rouse the people and encourage them in their protests. Speeches are made and prayers are offered. It is extremely well organized. Buses bring people to the protests. There are people there actually selling food, like at a ball game. The protesters say they'll have a meal before they become martyrs at the front, which is sort of odd. The masses that approach the fence are made up generally of young men and teenagers, including children. The protesters know how the security forces have been operating. They expect to be shot, or they realize that being shot is a distinct possibility. There are ambulance teams and medics, as numerous volunteers ready to take away the injured, many of them shot in the legs. The young men burn tires, prepare Molotov cocktails or slingshots and kites. The goal of the protesters is to get to the fence with select groups of young men who have brought wire cutters to cut through. Most of them don't make it that far, but some do. There is a barbed wire fence in sections to deter saboteurs reaching the main fence. Israel has continuously warned since March that anyone approaching this kind of buffer zone will be shot. It was a section of barbed wire fence that was torn down and dragged away late in April. The Palestinians cheered as he brought it up back to the protest camp. And it takes, according to reports, it takes about 60 seconds running between the barbed wire fence and the main security fence. So this is what's been going on. A well-organized, I don't even think you can use the word protest or demonstration. And now, keep in mind, what I've said up to now more or less is the facts, but keep in mind that, you know, the Palestinians claim they want to have a separate state, but what's happening at the Gaza fence is not an attempt in any way, shape, or form to create a Palestinian state. The whole goal of all of this is simply to kill Jews. And so that is the main reason for what's happening at the fence. It's not a protest against the fact that they don't have a state. It's simply that they are worked up, and they want to kill Jews. And they're being taught this in their schools, and which is a basic problem that no one seems to be addressing. When they talk about a two-state solution, they seem to forget that for the last 2 decades, the children starting in kindergarten are taught that Israel has no right to exist, and the Jews themselves have no right to live. So there are some, I guess you would call them, bleeding hearts in Israel who have a very odd attitude toward what's happening. What's happening is that tens of thousands of people, civilians interspersed with thousands of Hamas and Islamic Jihad terrorists, marching on our border with the intent to destroy the border, penetrate into Israel, and allow the terrorists to murder Israelis. It is not a peace demonstration. As a matter of fact, it is not a demonstration at all. What it really is a battlefield where anyone who approaches the fence is a combatant. That is the truth about what is happening there. Our unilateral withdrawal from Gaza, including the setting of the precedent of dismantling Jewish settlements, should have inspired the Gazans to embrace, or at the very least explore, the possibility of peace instead of going to war. It should have inspired the trade of goods and fostering economic ties. Instead, it led to missile fire and the resulting partial blockade, which is in order to protect Israel. And by the way, even now, while these violent demonstrations are taking place, Israel has offered to send medical aid into Gaza. Hamas has refused it. So obviously the Gaza population and its leadership are responsible for the choices they have made. They have chosen a leadership that regularly declares its desire to destroy Israel and acts on this desire. They are responsible for the tragedy of Gaza, and these are the facts. As a result, most Israelis believe that our moral responsibilities are limited to our efforts in self-defense. Now, what you have is some people in Israel, and I call them bleeding hearts, there's no other word, who write that they are, and I can quote some names, but I don't want to go into a polemic against individuals. I'm reading by some statements issued by rabbis here in Israel, who is saddened by the choices that the Gazans have made and the path that they've chosen to take. One rabbi writes, "I'm a devout two-statist who believes in the right of the Palestinian people to sovereignty in their own state, living side by side with Israel in peace and security for both of us. I'm angry because I believe that the hatred and violence coming out of Gaza has buried Israelis' belief in the viability of the two-state solution in our lifetime. Any discourse about a Palestinian state is immediately rejected under the counter-argument that it would just become another Gaza. And this Gaza, the new Gaza, if it includes Samaria, the Judea and Samaria, will be able to shut down all of Israel with mere mortar fire." Now, it's very interesting that this, I'm reading this from a statement issued by one of the two-staters who actually states the real facts. This is why we can't give them a state. And he says it's only an argument we have. So our soldiers have the challenge of protecting our borders, and that is what you have an army for. And that is why they have to take violent action, military action against this people, who even the left-wingers admit is a battlefield. First, on one hand, they admit it's a battlefield, then on the other hand, they say we have some kind of moral responsibility. Our soldiers are not violating international law. These left-wingers write things like, "Gaza paralyzes me because human beings are dying at my hands, and I do not know how to prevent it." It's interesting, by the way, these people, I don't know where their knowledge of history or anything, We are obviously not responsible for the reality, which is Gaza. But the left-wingers claim that, like all moral human beings, we must constantly ask ourselves whether and how we can be part of the solution. Now, you have a very interesting thing happening here. Let's go back to the Second World War. During the Second World War, the United States and Great Britain bombed Germany day and night. They bombed the German cities. There is no doubt that a lot of Germans were killed, Germans who were opposed to the Nazi regime. It's also quite possible, or reality, that a lot of Germans who were against the Nazi regime were drafted into the German army and were sent to the front to kill Russians or French or what have you. These are really problems. But this is what happens in war, and even the left-wingers themselves admit that Gaza is a battlefield, and in a battlefield, you do what you can to win. It is not our moral responsibility to worry about the casualties on the other side. Our moral responsibility is to our own people and to our own sovereign state. We're not responsible for the Nakba, not in Gaza, anywhere else. Going back in history, the Arab terrorists who attacked the Yishuv back when the UN made a partition plan in November 1947, then it was the Arab governments and their proxies who attacked in full force in 1948 against both Jewish civilians and Jewish armed forces when Israel declared independence. So starting with the attacks on the early Jewish settlement in Eretz Israel in Palestine, the late 19th century, the Mufti of Jerusalem and his followers made a savage response to the Zionist founders. This rabbi writes that we do not need to take moral responsibility for the reality, which is Gaza, but at the same time, we cannot allow our humanity and moral conscience to be so inert as to sit down and drink and not to speak of just dancing in our city squares, which we are doing, when we are causing, justifiably or not, death and chaos. We can believe that the events in Gaza are a war against Israel, support our soldiers, and still desire a public debate over the means necessary to win this war. Now, I don't understand how anybody can talk about a public debate about the necessity to win this war. We have a moral responsibility to our own people, to protecting our own citizen. Certainly we have to keep a certain military moral code. Even when force is used in self-defense, we should always use the amount of force necessary in proportion to the danger that we face. And we should try to avoid civilian casualties. But when civilians are used as soldiers against us, then they are essentially soldiers. And the left-wingers themselves admit that Gaza is a battlefield, and anybody's in that battlefield is looked upon as a soldier. Otherwise, they wouldn't be there. And as I said, we're not violating international law, and there's no reason whatsoever for any kind of public discourse about our soldiers, our experience. Our soldiers are being placed in situations where they must defend themselves and defend our country. And I do not believe that our soldiers are being placed in a morally compromised situation. They are in a war zone. They are defending Israel. In particular, they are defending those individuals who live along the border with Gaza, who are being threatened by these mobs who want to come in under instructions from their leaders to kill Jews. And there, I don't see what the moral problem is. The first thing you have to do is win. As I mentioned before, I doubt very much if any American pilots or men on B-17 bombers felt any moral responsibility or guilt that they were bombing the Germans. The idea was to win the war so there'd be less casualties in the long run. So we are, even the left-wingers admit, in a battlefield on the Gaza border, and we have to act accordingly. That is the long and the short of it. I'll be back after the break. Hello again, this is Jay Shapiro. In this segment of the program, I want to touch upon several topics which are not necessarily related. The first thing is that it looks like there is going to be a meeting between President Trump and the leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un. Now, what happened is the following. Back in April, he, the leader of the North Korea, met with the South Korean president, and it was the first time a North Korean leader had crossed the border to the south since 1948. In 1948, when the Korean Peninsula was divided in half. So this is a pretty dramatic thing, like Sadat's visit to Jerusalem. Apparently, the United States did a lot of secret mediation in this conflict, and it played an important role in the process of what could turn out to be a historic reconciliation. Now, because of this, and because Trump is such an unusual president, as a matter of fact, I remember I have a picture on my desk here back shortly after he became president. President Trump came and visited Israel, and his entourage passed the street that I live on. And as part of his visit, he went to the Western Wall, put on a skull cap, put a note in the wall, and said, "It's a tough deal, but we will get there." That's how it was quoted in the newspaper. And my own comment was that he was actually talking to the wall, with all the implications of that. But so far, it seems that Trump is having success vis-a-vis North and South Korea. Now, a lot of people think that because he managed to achieve some what appears to be at least an opening for success in Korea, then it'll work in Palestine. However, this is simply false because it is not based on the facts. There are many differences between the two conflicts, some of which are extremely fundamental. Now, there are those who claim that it has to do with the personality of the leaders, the role of the mediator, and the issues in dispute. But I think that's too broad an interpretation. The Korean conflict doesn't include some of the really harsh components of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. For example, there's no argument, I think, between North and South Korea where the border should be. It's been there and is going to stay there. North Korea and South Korea intend to remain independent. There is no problem of where the capital should be. In other words, the North Koreans are not interested in Seoul becoming the capital of North Korea, or Pyongyang becoming the capital of South Korea, whereas here we have an argument over the very status of our capital. And I don't think that the North Korean dictator is interested in destroying South Korea. He's more interested in protecting his own regime, not destroying somebody else's. And finally, the very, very important thing, and that is the subject of religion. Religion and jihad, holy war, is a basis of the Muslim intent toward the rest of the world, the non-Muslim world. And even the Muslims among themselves have a problem. You have Sunni Muslims and you have Shiite Muslims, and they don't get along too well with each other. As a matter of fact, that's one of the reasons that Saudi Arabia, which is a Sunni Muslim country, is pretty much putting aside its problems temporarily with Israel because its fear of the Shiite country, Iran. And that is why suddenly the Palestinians find themselves off the table because the Sunni countries are more interested in their own self-preservation than in yelling and screaming that a Palestinian state should be created. So the situation in the Middle East is entirely different than the situation on the Korean Peninsula, and all these pundits who start writing about the fact that if they can conciliate with each other, get along with each other there, they can do it here also. That is simply an avoidance of the facing and looking the facts straight in the eye. I want to say a couple final thoughts about what's happening on the Gaza border, because hopefully by the time of our program next week, this will be no longer be an issue. But I want to sum up what some of the things I've said on this program. First of all, there are armed terrorists who are indistinguishable from unarmed civilians. The civilians themselves can often pose a violent threat. So it's hard to see how the Israeli army, the IDF, could avoid inflicting casualties in defense of our country and our people. That is why the IDF has been obliged to act to prevent this situation from getting out of hand. They have occasionally used live fire, which again occasionally has been lethal, despite heavy and inevitable international condemnation, which is what is happening. As in their reactions to previous bouts of violence, the IDF has adopted a graduated response. First, they airdropped thousands of leaflets on Gaza. They use SMS, social media, a radio broadcast to warn the people of Gaza not to gather at the border or to approach the fence. They contacted the Gaza bus company, believe it or not. That's how far they went. And they asked the owners of the buses and asked them not to transport people to the border. That's how far our army went. However, all these appeals were nullified by Hamas coercion against the civilian population. And so the IDF used tear gas to disperse the crowds that approached the fence. And an order and pretty much of an innovative effort to increase precision and effectiveness, they sometimes use drones to deliver the tear gas. Yet tear gas does not always provide a solution, as its effectiveness is limited by time and wind conditions and by the ability of the people to mitigate its most serious effects against them. Next, the IDF used warning shots fired overhead. Finally, only where it became necessary by their rules of engagement, using ball ammunition aimed to disable rather than kill. Although in some cases shooting to kill would have been lawful, the IDF maintained that even then they still only fired shots to disable, except in cases where there were clear instances of military attacks, such as shooting attacks against the IDF soldiers. In all cases, the IDF forces operate according to standard operating procedures, which were drafted to suit the circumstances and compiled in conjunction with various authorities in the IDF. The soldiers had specific instructions on how to behave. However, nonetheless, several people died as a result of this gunfire. Many more were wounded. The Palestinian authorities claim about 60 people have been killed and about 2,700 more wounded. Of those killed, by the way, Israel assesses that 80% were terrorist operatives and individuals associated with them, and Hamas admitted to this. The price in human life, suffering, and adverse international opinion has undoubtedly been high. However, the bottom line is that the fence has not been penetrated, and therefore an even higher price has been avoided. Now, many have argued that Israel should have acted differently in response to this threat, including the UN Middle East envoy, who condemned Israel's actions as outrageous, and the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights condemned the use of excessive force by Israel. The ICC prosecutor for the International Criminal Court asserted that violence against civilians in a situation such as the one in Gaza could constitute crimes under the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. This is what all these officials have been saying about Israel's attempts, successful attempts, to defend itself. So the world has gotten all worked up. As a matter of fact, the UN had one moment of silence for memory of those who were killed at the border. Yet, despite all their condemnations, not one of these officials, any other experts, has come or put forward any viable alternative course of action to prevent violent penetration of our borders. But some have contended that Israeli troops use excessive force because they fired live bullets against demonstrators who posed no imminent threat to life. The UN expressed alarm over the use of live ammunition as a means of crowd control. The truth of the matter is, the so-called demonstrators did pose an imminent threat to life. As I read previously on this program, there were instructions given by Hamas to the people who were going to participate in these so-called protests. Today, it's well accepted in international law that live ammunition can be used when there's a serious threat of death or injury, and where no other means have succeeded in confronting the threat. There is no requirement that the threat be immediate. Such force can be used at the point when it becomes imminent, when there is no intermediate stage in which an aggressive action can be prevented before it becomes an immediate threat. In other words, they say you can't do anything, you can't fire live ammunition unless there's an immediate threat. A threat can become immediate very fast. The reality is that under the conditions of liberty created by Hamas, there was no intermediate step that could have been taken short of shooting those who posed a threat. And these people, who can hardly be called demonstrators, had they been permitted to reach the fence with not just an imminent but an immediate threat to life, which could only have been prevented by inflicting far higher casualties on the attackers. So those who argue that the IDF should not have resorted to live ammunition are in fact arguing they should have waited until the violent rioters, including terrorists, had stormed into Israeli territory, which makes no sense whatsoever. Some also contended they could find no evidence of any protesters using firearms, which is absolutely not true. Even the instructions given by Hamas, as I mentioned previously, said hide the knives under your coats. Hamas has spent years and millions of dollars digging attack tunnels into Israel underground. That is a serious threat that involves spades, not guns. Now, as well as continuing to dig tunnels, they're trying to do things above ground, using their own population as cover. The guns will only be pulled out once they've achieved their aim of forcing a mass penetration. A soldier waiting for a gun to appear would be signing his own death warrant and that of the civilians he or she is there to protect. There's been criticism, especially by the Human Rights Watch, that Israeli officials allegedly allowed illegal actions by soldiers. They claimed that the IDF chief of staff and the prime minister's spokesman have said things that are evidence of incitement. Probably hasn't occurred to them that these officials exercise authority through private communication channels, not public media, and such comments are not instructions to troops, but rather warnings to Gaza civilians made in order to reduce the prospects of violence. And also, they want to allay the valid fears of Israelis living close to the border. When our chief of staff says he's positioning 100 snipers on the border, That is an expression of his lawful duty to defend his country, not an admission of intention to use unlawful force. Human rights groups and media commentators have criticized use of force by the Israeli army on the basis there have been no reports of injuries to soldiers. They have suggested that this indicates a disproportionate response. As so often in commenting on the operation of Western forces, these so-called experts misunderstand or misrepresent the realities of security operation and the dictates of the law, and indeed is not necessary to show harm in order to demonstrate the existence of a real threat. The fact that IDF soldiers were not seriously wounded demonstrates their military professionalism, not the lack of threat. Imagine how these people would comment on the Second World War by saying the Allies used disproportionate force against the Germans and against the Japanese. In a war, you use the required force to achieve your objective. By the way, we've also seen the claim that in the absence of armed hostilities, use of force in Gaza is governed by international human rights law, not the laws of armed conflict. But they themselves, the Arabs, the Palestinians, say this is a battle. This is a false position on the part of those who say it's not an armed conflict. The whole of Gaza is a war zone made so by Hamas's armed aggression against the state of Israel. The law applicable depends on the precise circumstances, and the precise circumstances is that it is a combat zone, and it's lawful for the IDF to engage and kill an identified enemy anywhere in Gaza, whether if the enemy identified whether in or out of uniform, whether armed or unarmed, or whether or not presenting an imminent threat, whether attacking or running away. In practice, however, in contending with the violent riots, the IDF seems to have been operating on the assumption all persons are civilians and thus do not resort to legal force as a first resort, unless it is clearly apparent to be otherwise. Our army is, I claim, the most moral army in the world. Now, another thing is there have been claims that the Israeli government has refused to carry out any official inquiry into the deaths incurred. Now, this is entirely false. The Israelis have stated they'll examine incidents using their own internationally respected legal systems. What the Israeli government said is that it refuses to bow down to calls for an international inquiry, such as having the United States or United Kingdom or any other Western country who would also refuse such a thing. All these false criticisms of Israeli action, as well as the threats to initiate international investigations, they want to put Israel in front of the International Commission, invoke universal jurisdiction against Israeli officials. These play into the hands of Hamas. There's no two ways about it. They validate the use of human shields and Hamas's strategy of forcing the killing of their own civilians. The implications are wider than just for this conflict. It can be seen in earlier bouts of violence. Similar international reaction, including unjust combination, caused more widespread use of such tactics by people like Hamas. And it increases its death among innocent civilians anywhere in the world. Now, there will probably be more deaths than we have seen so far, because Hamas is very loose about dealing with the lives of the Palestinians. It's also probable that we'll see heightened combination in the media and among international organizations and human rights groups against Israel. Those with an anti-U.S. as well as anti-Israel agenda will inevitably link this violence to President Trump's decision to open the U.S. embassy in Jerusalem. So, I don't want to say any more on this subject. I just want to close the future matters. I'm sort of tired of it myself. But I've tried as much as possible to present to listeners the situation, in particular on the Gaza border, how Israel's responding, how the world is responding to Israel's response, and why we are justified 100% in what we're doing. I'll be back after the break. Hi, you're back with Jay Shapiro. I can't wait till the as late as possible to record this part of the program to see if there's any news so that I'm not overtaken by events. But this week, Sunday is going to be the holiday of Shavuot, so I'm going to record this program on Friday morning. Now, Friday is a time generally when the Arabs like to make trouble, because that's when they gather in the mosque. That's their Sabbath. And then they get the listeners, the worshipers, all worked up against Israel. So I'm going to continue on the topic of what's been happening on the Gaza border, because it's a good possibility it'll continue today. And there's some points about that I want to stress. The great Hamas march of return came with instructions, as I mentioned previously, to bring a knife, a dagger, or a handgun, if you have one, and leave them under your clothes and not use them or show them except if you identify one of the soldiers or settlers. According to the Hamas Prime Minister, Yahya Sinwar, he said, "We will tear down the border and we will tear out their hearts from their bodies." They have a very interesting way of talking. The Hamas mob chanted Allahu Akbar, which means God is great, and the racist threat of Khabar Khabar Ya Yahud, which is a reference to the Islamic massacre of the Jews in the city of Khabar back in the time of Mohammed. While the Israeli army, the IDF soldiers, held back the invaders, the IAF aircraft targeted the striking the Hamas compounds and outposts. The Hamas organizers changed course because of this attack, and they began urging their people to stop fence attacks. Interestingly enough, Hamas had offered $100 to every rioter. During the previous violent assaults back in April, the Muslim Brotherhood terrorist group had been offering $200 to anyone shot by Israelis, $500 for severe injuries, and $3,000 for anybody killed. Now, $100 a day may not seem like a lot. Keep in mind that Israeli soldiers, many of whom were in their teens, these are the people that the Hamas is trying to kill. These Israeli soldiers earn about $13 a day. The Hamas-supporting thugs are depicted as helpless, starving victims who can barely lift the firebombs they're throwing at Israelis, but they actually make 10 times as much as the Israeli soldier that they're trying to kill. Now, Hamas can spend all this money because the cash is coming from Iran. Iran is the big supporter of what's happening on the Gaza Strip. Last year, Israel released one of the killers, a guy named Sinwar. He was released in exchange for a captured Israeli hostage named Gilad Shalit. And Sinwar boasted that Iran was once again the largest backer financially and militarily. It comes to an estimated $100 million a year. Now, consider the following. As many as 50,000 Hamas supporters in Gaza participating in the attacks on Israel at $100 a head. Over 1,000 allegedly injured get at least $200 each, and another 52 allegedly killed get $3,000 each. The whole thing cost Hamas and Iran $5.3 million. The unmarked cargo plane filled with foreign currency that Obama dispatched to Iran carried $400 million, which was part of a known $1.7 billion cash payment. But the total Obama terrorist payments to Iran may go as high as $33.6 billion. Despite the misreporting by the media, the Hamas mass fence attacks began back in March, and even though the Great March of Return was supposed to end in mid-May, the show proved to be unexpectedly popular in Europe and in Tehran, attacks will continue through at least June. Even a single one of Obama's cash smuggling runs to Iran is enough to fund attacks just like these for 2.5 months. And the $100,000 that an Iranian group offered to anyone who blows up the embassy, that's illegal cash run can pay for bounties to every American diplomatic facility in the world. These terrorists are offering money for killing Jews or even for blowing up an American embassy. So there are dozens dead. If the Israeli teens shooting in self-defense lack moral authority, where is the moral authority of those who gave Tehran the money to finance this? These Israeli teens in the army earn $408 a month if they're in a combat unit. Before a raise a few years ago, they weren't even earning $300. Support units, so combat units earn $408 a month. Support units earn $327 a month, and rear units get $225 a month, which is not only lower than the average civilian salary, but it hardly covers living expenses for most of these young men. Hamas supporters charge at the Israeli soldiers for $100 a day, and the IDF soldiers hold the line for $400 a month. Very interesting. I just saw these statistics the other day. I find them very fascinating. So why for $400 a month do the Israeli soldiers face down mobs of tens of thousands of Hamas supporters? Many of the IDF soldiers who report for duty come from one of the Judean communities, the settlements under attack by Hamas, or from development towns in the north under attack by Hezbollah. The soldier is often a religious settler who sees the hand of God in what's happening. When your family lives under fire, holding the line on the Hamas mob is not an abstract idea of duty. The Hamas invaders are there to kill Israelis. The Israeli soldiers are there to protect Israelis. The attackers were invading someone else's land while the defenders were protecting their own country. That's why Hamas apparently has to pay its thugs 10 times as much as Israeli soldiers earn to attack them. While the $100 a day rioters throw rocks and firebombs, the professional terrorists hung back waiting for a breach in the fence. Some were caught planting bombs and killed. They are among the known Hamas terrorists killed in the Gaza fighting and bemoaned by the media as victims of a Jewish massacre. The $400 a month Israeli teenager with a rifle is there on the front line in case the fence is breached. Hamas wants to take more hostages to free more terrorists. If it can't do that, it will kill them. And if the attackers make it past the soldiers, they'll hit Israeli towns and villages, hoping to kill anyone they find. While the fence holds up, the Hamas terrorists and their supporters send flaming kites in the hopes of setting Israeli farms and fields on fire. One such attack has already destroyed 400 acres of wheat. A sympathetic New York Times piece last week described the flaming kite squadrons, which caused hundreds of fires, but the wind, unfortunately, was blowing the other way. So Hamas organized this invasion. It urged its human shields to head toward the fence, telling them that the Israelis had run away. By the way, this is the same thing that happened when, back in 1967, Nasser, the president of Egypt, had tricked Jordan's King Hussein during the Six-Day War. Instead of defeating the Israelis and salvaging Gaza, Nasser's scheme led to the liberation of Jerusalem along with Judea and Samaria by Israel. Anyhow, while the Hamas supporters were destroying their own crossing point infrastructures, they'd previously trashed their own gas lines, the United States was inaugurating the opening of an embassy in Jerusalem. So despite the media misinformation, the riots predated the embassy, and the riots will continue into June. Interesting that the media used contrasting photos of the embassy opening and the fake photos of protesters crying for the cameras and pretending to limp on crunches in order to smear Israel and America. And as usual, the media missed the real story. While Israelis and Americans were building something, Muslim terrorists destroying everything they get their hands on. That's what it's all about. The dedication of the embassy is a leap of faith. Faith in building rather than destruction. Faith in life instead of death. Faith in God. So that is the real comparison between what was happening in Jerusalem, the opening of the American embassy, while the Gaza rioters were running up against the Israeli fence and getting paid to do it. The truth of the matter is, it's kind of as if there were two Israels. There's the Israel of Jerusalem, with the U.S. embassy being celebrated, and then there's Gaza, where the Arabs are rioting. By the way, there are two ways of looking at this reality. There are those who will claim the celebrations in Jerusalem are sort of not taking into account what's happening around them, that Israelis are apathetic to the loss of life, how Israelis live in a bubble. They ignore the reality of the conflict that surrounds them. The truth of the matter is that the opposite is what is happening. Israelis care, but they simply don't let conflict stop them from celebrating life. Israel has faced nonstop conflict since the state's inception 70 years ago, but it hasn't brought the people down. Look at the history. There was a war in the north in 2006, but coffee shops in Tel Aviv were filled. Should the people have stayed home out of solidarity with the people of the north? Maybe. But let's keep in mind the message we send to our enemies by living life. They can try, but they won't defeat our spirit. Some of the speeches at the embassy ceremony were very interesting while the violence was raging in Gaza. The speakers spoke about peace. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said this is a good day for peace, and Jared Kushner, who represented Trump, said peace is within reach if we dare to believe the future can be different than the past. So the real question is, what peace are they talking about? Hamas is busy sending thousands of people to be killed or injured in a futile attempt to illegally break the border with Israel. And the Palestinian Authority President Abbas, only a few weeks ago, spread vile anti-Semitic theories about the Holocaust. And by the way, the head of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, referred to the U.S. Ambassador David Friedman as the son of a dog. They could, however, talk about peace because none of the above mattered when they opened the embassy. After years of clashing with U.S. presidents, our prime minister showed the world he not only knows how to work with one, but he can also win significant and strategic achievements for Israel. For Trump, by the way, it's very interesting. Trump showed the American people that he keeps his promises. That was exactly the tone of the White House's press release on the ceremony when the embassy was opened. The White House press release said President Donald J. Trump keeps his promise to open the U.S. embassy in Jerusalem, Israel. So Trump made good on his promise and let the world know that he made good on his promise. And since it was something that hadn't been done by any previous president, then President Trump certainly had something to brag about. It seems that most of the world and most of the media failed to understand a very simple fact. If Israel had not used force to stop the Palestinians trying to storm the border fence, the casualty toll would have been far worse than it was. Even if 1,000 Palestinians succeeded in crossing the border, they could have ended up inside one of the nearby Israeli communities where the Israeli army would have been forced to use even greater force to stop them. No military in the world has come up with an effective way to peacefully stop 50,000 people from trying to infiltrate and cross an internationally recognized border. No matter how much tear gas and how many water cannons you deploy, people will be able to get through in big numbers. There is also no military in the world, no army in the world that would simply let a violent mob incited and directed by a ruthless terror regime, it would not allow such a mob to cross into its territory without using extreme force to stop it. Anybody who claims the opposite is simply false and absurd. Of course, the problem that Israel had, that Israel failed to appreciate the significance of the images that were collecting along the border, and they fell into a trap by failing to recognize the importance of the foreign press on international relations. You have to allow, what the Israeli army did was it prevented a lot of the foreign journalists from coming up front. It could well be because they're afraid they would be injured or killed, which wouldn't be good. But by keeping them away, keeping the foreign press away, they don't really see what's happening. And so they are subject to what they hear from the propagandists on the other side. It's very important for Israel to try and control the narrative. It was obvious there'd be a lot of violence, and instead of allowing Hamas to take control of the way the media saw what has happened, they could have, for example, embedded reporters with the Israeli troops, letting them see up close what was really happening along the border. Even if it meant putting them in harm's way, a lot of these correspondents are in harm's way all over the world. That's been that way since correspondents started joining together with armies to report what's happening at the front. Of course, there are a lot of people who say that no matter what Israel does, it'll never succeed in getting fair media coverage. There is some truth to that claim, but it doesn't absolve the Israeli government for doing the best they can to allow the foreign press get close, so that at least they'd have very great difficulty in lying about what was happening. There are three battlefields in any war today. That's the way it is. There are two places. The first battlefield is the place where the fighting is actually taking place. It could be today in Gaza or Lebanon, Syria. The second battlefield is the home front, where the enemy rockets will land, and you have to keep the people strong and confident. And then there is the combination of diplomatic and media front, which is also a front in the war. And Israel has failed up till now to really cover that front well. Thank God we're doing well in the first two fronts, the actual fighting and the home front. We're not doing too well in the diplomatic and media front. That's something Israel has to correct. So this is a summary of what's been happening this week. Let's hope things are quieter today, which is Friday, and next week till you hear from me again. Take care of yourselves, and let's hope and even pray that we have a quiet week. Goodbye to everybody till next week. And, of course, I'm Mrs. Calabash, Jay Shapiro, signing off.